ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
4, 3, 2, 1.
G'day, Dr. Carl here.
And lift off.
40 years on, we want to unpack the behind-the-scenes story of the Challenger disaster.
Obviously a major malfunction.
I saw it explode. I couldn't believe it.
Hear the whole story on our podcast, The Challenger Legacy, a new series of science fiction. Search for science fiction on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas, Natasha Mitchell at the Women of the World, or WOW Festival's Schools Day. I've got a crowd of high school students with me. We are getting ready to wow you with the life stories of four young changemakers. They are can-do women, let me tell you. You'll meet Monique Mermaid Murphy. She's a Paralympian silver medalist in swimming.
Stepping forward to get that medal, I just let go of my identity being tied to that accident. And it was like, if I can do this, then I can figure out how to do everything else.
Somalian Australian community leader and poet Nasteo Mukhtar works to empower culturally diverse women as a program coordinator of Ethni. She's also a Muay Thai martial arts fighter.
And I was like, I want to be in your fight team. I want to fight. And he's like, have you trained before? And I was like, no, but I'm going to fight.
Oh, it was in you.
I was like, I'm going to be a world champion. I'm going to fight.
Proud Jarawa Waka Waka Willy Willy woman, Larisha Jerome is the founder of Liberate with Larisha. She's focused on First Nations economic justice and financial empowerment.
There's sometimes where I'm the only woman in a lot of rooms, especially in the finance industry, and they're like, what is this little girl like coming in here to tell me? They're like, you know, I'm making $200,000 a year. Like, what is she going to teach me?
And Claudia Karovsky just finished Year 11 at Cairns State High School. She's co-founder of a youth-led charity called the Gratitude Initiative and former Youth Minister of Health in the YMCA Queensland Youth Parliament.
I wanted to form a political belief of my own. I think it's very important for everyone to... You can be non-partisan, that's great, you know, having neutrality, but it's also great to sort of have a moral foundation so that you know what you believe in.
Yeah, if you're wondering who the second female Prime Minister of Australia might be, there's a good bet right there. At the Queensland Centre of Performing Arts on Yuggera and Turrbal Country, for the benefit of the high school students in the room, let's find out where life was at when these changemakers were the same age, starting with Monique.
In Year 10, I had two legs, I had two arms, 10 fingers, 10 toes, and I wanted to be a swimmer. I knew that I was good at swimming. It was my talent, and that if I put effort in, then I could excel that talent. And I was waiting for that standout performance to just elevate me, you know, to a path to get to an Olympic Games. So I was sure about where I wanted to be. I wasn't sure about how to get there.
Oh, interesting. Larisha, where were you at?
Well, I was actually not a great student back then. So I tried everything to get out of all my classes during the day. So I actually did a school-based traineeship, which started my career in finance. I actually worked as a banker and a teller at Commonwealth Bank. And then straight after high school, I actually was homeless, surprisingly. And that's where my power came from, where I wanted to use everything that I've learnt as a banker, working with money all the time. And then, you know, I was like, I'm not going to be in this situation forever. And then I ended up buying my house at 21. Yeah, I bought my house, and I guess that's where my finance world kind of started.
Wow. Naz, what about you? Where were you at in your mid-teens, early to mid-teens?
I was a lawyer, a doctor, and a navigator of a new country whilst trying to learn a new language. Coming here at the age of 14 with my mother and my siblings who were younger than me, I had to be the adult in the house because I learned English before my mother, so I had to interpret legal documents. I had to go to school, be a student and a child, but come home and be this adult. that had to knew how to navigate everything and work a new system. So even at school at times, I was expected to excel and, you know, be catching up to the subjects. And I was like, I was illiterate like 6 months ago. I don't understand how you expect me to do well in this subject. So most of my high school years were figuring out, I guess, the education system, and then how to be a young person and an adult at the same time.
Phenomenal. A lawyer, a doctor, an advocate, an educator, all at that, all at 14. Claudia, where were you 2 years ago? Take us back to year nine.
All right, back to year nine. So I wasn't always political. I remember asking in my year 10 literature class, what is left wing and right wing, which was really embarrassing to be clocked by my teacher. So I guess back then I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I did know one thing, and it's that I hate misogyny. I would sort of walk around the school and I'd hear little things and no one would really stand up to it. And I'd go, I see the discrepancy here. So I definitely do think everyone in the room can relate that you hear those little snarky comments at school and it is way too normalized at the moment. You hear those just little things like, go make me a sandwich, and you think it's a little bit ridiculous, it's immature, but it's the little things like that that really just make hidden misogyny just really evident. And it's really hard as a young girl going through school and you're overlooked, you're undermined. So I guess for me, it's really just making those little changes on a state or a federal parliament scale. We definitely do need to see more women in politics. And I guess my fire for that is really just coming from a regional area and not seeing a lot of myself. You don't see a lot of young leaders, young female leaders, because I definitely do think that as well. We sort of have an embarrassment problem in high schools at the moment. People are too scared to say things that they care about. People are too scared to, you know, advocate on changes that really are imperative and that we need to see changed. So I guess that's where my passion comes from, really just being that outlier and hopefully showing other girls that it's okay to, you know, care about what you're passionate about without, you know, feeling embarrassed about it.
That's so powerful, finding your voice and also claiming your voice and not shying away from staking that claim. Monique, so you move out of high school and you're moving into uni and life's pretty sweet by the sounds. You're socialising, learning. What happens when you're on the cusp of turning 20 and you're at a party?
A big life change happened, what I thought was a wrecking ball, and probably in hindsight, not so much. It was 2 weeks before my 20th birthday and we had a uni event. Now, I worked at the university. I was a resident assistant at that village. And so I wasn't interested in getting drunk at my workplace. So I went down with one drink. I had no more alcohol in my apartment. I'd purposely not bought any. I walked downstairs and then a week later, I woke up in hospital. So I have no memory after walking down those stairs. I woke up to my parents' faces. Now, I lived in Melbourne at this time. My parents were divorced. So my first thought was, oh, shit, I've done something really bad. Like, I'm in trouble if my parents have had to come down. They kept saying they love me. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, I'm amazing. Of course you love me. But I could not remember what had happened. And it was almost like this sort of, my body kind of did this scan. And it was like, I could understand my parents. I could hear them. I knew where I could, you know, see where I was. So I was like, you know, there's no brain damage.
But you'd woken up in a broken body.
I had fallen from a fifth floor balcony. I had landed on a glass roof and that had resulted in me being put into an induced coma for a week and on life support. And they'd amputated my right foot immediately because it had basically just turned to dust.
But then you were facing, well, not really a decision, another reality, and that was a leg amputation. A year later, you were competing in the Paralympics. Let's just be clear here. So something interesting was happening in your brain through this catastrophic process.
Yeah, so I think because throughout high school, I wanted to be an Olympian, I trained. So I did seven swim sessions a week, gym, everything was about, you know, putting in work and seeing that effort paid off. So I knew the algorithm. I knew that I had to put in effort in order to see a result. And that mindset is what got me through that accident. So they'd amputated my foot at the heel. They wanted to amputate below the knee because the doctors knew that would give me access to far better prosthetics and therefore a better quality of life. But my mum told the doctor no. She said, that is her decision. and she needs to make that. So literally on my 20th birthday, I'm making a decision as to whether I should amputate more of my leg or not. And for me, it was a gut feeling straight away as soon as they said, you will have more mobility. I thought, that's what I want.
So how did the water that you were so well acquainted with, you were a mermaid, you were a water baby, but how did the water become both your healer and your power? Water and swimming.
Like I said, I was always trying to make this big jump to get onto that Olympic pathway, and I never so much as qualified for a national championships. So that first step, I just never got there. And so I'd given it up knowing that I did not give it my full effort, knowing there was untapped potential in swimming. And that stuck with me. So I was in hospital for about 7 weeks. I had about 9 surgeries. And then I had to go to a rehab, which is where they made my prosthetic and I got to learn how to walk again. And there was a pool. And when I got into that pool for the first time, they had to lower me in a mechanical wheelchair, which felt so humiliating because something I used to just, you know, walk to the edge of the pool and dive in, I now needed, you know, a team of people to lift me from a wheelchair to another wheelchair,
But when you were in that water?
It was like freedom.
Freedom.
You know, I had so much mobility in that water because it's supporting you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like sort of a metaphor. I had that support in the water and suddenly I could move in a way I couldn't on land.
A year later, you're in the Paralympics. 900 days later, you are winning a silver medal at the Paralympics. And the win at the silver medal, what did that feel like?
I think for the winning the silver medal, it's nice and heavy.
It is, and it's very well rubbed.
Yeah,
many people have handled this. Oh, God, that is heavy.
So I was very sick on the day of my race. I'd been in the athlete's village for 2 weeks, gotten a cold. I wasn't focused on a medal. I was focused on doing my best because if I did a personal best time and came fourth, I was going to be happy with that and not let the media or the coaches or anyone else tell me otherwise. Because we do have a problem in Australia with not celebrating every achievement and only celebrating the gold. And when I hit that wall and saw the number 2, I was in shock. And stepping forward to receive that medal, it was like at the end of that race, I allowed my body to be sick. I'd kind of been pushing it to the side, not acknowledging it. And I was bawling my eyes out. I had the runniest nose and I was thinking, oh my God, I'm going to get a snot bubble right in my Paralympic photo. I'm going to have a giant snot bubble. But stepping forward to get that medal, it was like I left the trauma of the accident behind.
Yeah.
You know, it was incredibly traumatic. It's not something you ever wish anyone has to go through, but I just let go of my identity being tied to that accident. And it was like, if I can do this, then I can figure out how to do everything else.
And she has ever since. What an amazing story. Thank you. Thank you. Naz Mukhtar, talking about building the capacity of the body, tell us about turning to Muay Thai martial arts, because this isn't just any martial art. This is full on. This is a combat, full body combat experience, isn't it? What led you there?
So in my village, we didn't have a cinema and we had like a tiny TV room. You know those old, like old school televisions where they have like the fat ass background like attached to it? I don't know what it does, but that's what it had.
This is a village, you're talking about village back in Somalia?
Yes, yeah. And it was given to us by one of the humanitarians that came through the village. But no girls were allowed in there because like all the men in the afternoon would go in there to watch like their films and stuff. But during the day, they made one mistake. They said, we couldn't go to school. The boys could go to school and then the older men would go to work. I was a menace as a child. And my mother could not keep up with me. So if I was not climbing trees or the mountains, I would go there to watch films. There was 4 movies. Two of them were Bollywood movies. One called Kabhi Khushi Kabhi Gham. The other one called Disco Dancer. And the other two were Rocky 2 and Rocky 3. I still don't know what happens in Rocky 1. 4 or 5. I don't know even if they came out. So I would watch Rocky 2 and Rocky 3 on repeat. To the point where any time that he's running up the stairs and then he gets to the end, Eye of the Tiger is playing and he's like shadow boxing, I'll start copying him. So when we came here, and I went to Yoronga State High School. So on the way, once I got off the train station, there was a boxing gym just literally like down the road. And every day I walk past and I watch them hit the pads, I watch them hit the bag, and I was like, I'm gonna go in there. And then I went in there and I was like, I wanna fight. And then the reception was like, you gotta pay. And I was like, a bit expensive, I'll come back. So I finished school, got myself a part-time job, got my license, literally drove from the Department of Transport to the nearest gym I could get to. I'm still at that gym. I walk in and the owner was like at the reception and he was like, hello, my name is Dan, how can I help you? And I was like, I want to be in your fight team, I want to fight. And he's like, have you trained before? And I was like, no, but I'm going to fight.
Oh, it was in you.
I was like, I'm going to be a world champion, I'm going to fight. And he was like, okay, we'll see, just come to class. 6 months later, he was like, do you want to fight? And I was like, I told you I want to fight. I've been waiting. So that's how I got into it.
It's kind of amazing that because you'd actually escaped fighting, hadn't you? Your family escaped the civil war in Somalia and came to Australia via a refugee camp. You'd fled fighting, but here you were learning how to fight with the philosophy wrapped around you of Muay Thai, and it was about empowerment, yeah?
It very much is about empowerment. I think it mostly comes from my mother. She was not dealing only with the war in the country, but she was dealing with the war in her own family, into the man that she was married to. And then even when we got to the camp, she was not just dealing with worrying about if she's going to get enough food for her children to eat, but protecting her children because we were sharing tents with other men or people that we have never met before. Mm. So she's always been a fighter in my eyes. And to see her resilience, I think that helped me understand that to fight is to have a purpose in life, to have a discipline in life. Obviously, violence is ugly, but when you have violence with purpose, it's not so ugly. So it's good to fight for the things that you're passionate about and you care about.
Somalian Australian community leader Nasteo Mukhtar on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. You're with me, Natasha Mitchell, hello. And you're meeting four extraordinary women who are creating the change that they want to see in the world. With an audience of high school students in Mianjin, Brisbane, it's back to Naz.
You also turned to politics a bit. I think you repped on your student council. You got really active at school. Were you having to confront or challenge or push back against perceptions, misperceptions about what it was to be a refugee girl?
Absolutely. That's what my poem that I'm going to read out today is about. I think it's not even just like in our small groups, it is in the wide Australian society around the world. If you look at like the protests that are happening and they're like, these refugees are coming here to take our jobs and to take our lands. Is what you need to realize is like, we don't wake up one day and go, you know what, this is the country I'm going to go to. Or we don't wake up one day and go, you know what, I just feel like leaving everyone at that I've ever known and everyone that I've ever loved to go somewhere where I have no idea even how to say hello in their language. It takes a great desperation to force someone to leave their home country. And when I say their home country, it's not the land itself, it's about the heart. Mm. And the soul that feels so deeply connected to that country.
And that deep history where you have multiple generations of your family story emerging from that land.
I think from like year 12 on, I gained a sense of like confidence and self-identity because I finally understood the language and I could speak back. And I had really amazing teachers at school who helped empower me. And through their leadership and guidance, I was able to get on the school council and get on other youth groups to be able to like advocate for other young women like me who might not have the platform or the privilege to be able to speak about the things that I can.
Or the force of Muay Thai driving you forward. But now you're involved as a program coordinator of Ethni. What's Ethni about?
So Ethni is a non-profit. We work with young women from refugee, asylum seeker or disadvantaged background. Our main thing is Sisters for Sisters. and that no girl or woman should be left behind. When one of us can stand at the front, the rest of us can get there.
Yeah.
One figured out how to get there, so let's go. They connect on the meaning of like womanhood and what it means to just be a girl in this world. Whether you come from comfort or whether you come from discomfort, the world is still going to be mean to us.
Yeah.
In some way or another. So they build on each other's strength, and that's, I think, what Ethne does really well.
Sort of finding a common conversation. And absolutely. From Ethne, this year you have co-founded and you manage a social enterprise that isn't just about young women, it's also about elders as well. So you're just reaching out to everyone. You want the revolution to be for all women. The name of it is, and I'll let you say it, but it's the Swahili word for flower. So this is about helping women bloom through what? Tell us about it.
It's called Mawa. Almost in every language or in every dialect, when they speak about women, they describe them in the sense of beautiful flowers and how delicate they are. And one day I was having a discussion with another young woman. She's not a young woman, she's a girl actually. She's 12 years old. And she said, some flowers are also really strong. And I was like, yeah, they are. And from there on, we were like, oh, we're going to create a small group where we bridge the gap between the aunties, the mothers in our communities, and our young women. I think a lot of the mothers or the aunties came to this country with a really good intention. They wanted their children to get education. They wanted their children to advance and have the opportunities that they themselves may not have had.
Yeah.
But there's a loss of identity and connection with the young women. When they come here, they learn, they get all of this freedom to wear what they want to wear, to go to school, to get employment, to see all of these other women thriving in other different areas of life. So they start taking their own journeys. And there's a disconnect between the older generation that had one way of thinking, not the wrong way of thinking, just a different way of thinking and being in this country and seeing the opportunities available. And then you have the young women who are coming through saying, no, but I want to be free and liberated in a different way. Like, I'm grateful for the opportunity, but I have a different path that now I want to take.
And that can create tensions, can't it, and distress
absolutely.
Sometimes, because the elders are kind of left in a sort of no woman's land in a way, stuck between home culture, new culture. Where is their connection? Where is their community if their children are moving on into another world?
Yeah, absolutely. And we just really wanted to reduce that social isolation where they could still be part of their kids' lives. So we create impact workshops now where all the other aunties will come together, have tea and biscuits. They create flowers, perfumes, candles, whatever they want to do. We just bring the resources because Mawa creates those products. We go to the markets.
It's a gift shop.
It's a gift shop.
A social enterprise that's a gift shop.
Yeah, and we sell those products. So for every product that we sell, buys a one of the women to come to the workshop, and we take those resources and that money to create an impact workshop where it's an intergenerational conversation, and the aunties can bring their daughters and just have a good time.
And you're also a poet, and I just want you to say, what was it about finding your poetic voice that was another form of expression, another form of power? And we're going to hear from Naz a bit later.
I think it was mostly because of my English teacher, Mrs. Zoe. The first school that I went to was Milpara State High School. It's just to teach you basic English and basic high school languages, so you can, not languages, subjects, so you can transition to high school. And every morning we will walk in, she's either reading a poem or listening to Bon Jovi, which is why now I love rock music.
Awesome. That's a form of poetry.
Yeah, it is a form of poetry. And she just really got me into art and what it means to explore yourself and your identity through art. We used to do reflective journals, and that was my only way of expressing myself, really, at the beginning. And it just stuck since then.
Cannot wait to hear your... because you'll also be channeling your mother in the piece that you're going to perform. Larisha Jerome, we've talked about physical power, but at the heart of what you do with Liberate with Larisha, your consultancy, is about financial power. It's about economic power. I mean, to go from being a baker, a bank teller, homeless, buying your own home at 21, something was stirring in your soul, some realization. What was it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what was stirring in my soul was really, you know, getting out of that scarcity mindset and really, you know, building myself up until I reached the abundance mindset. Obviously, in high school, you know, I was in residential care and then I became homeless. And then I ended up moving up to Queensland, up here from Sydney. And that's where I bought my first home at 21. And I guess every single role that I've ever done has always been finance, which is so strange because when I was in school, I didn't really like finance at all. Mm-hmm. But I just naturally went into those roles. And I guess the banking, you know, I just didn't want to go to school. So it was like, I want to make money. I love money.
I have to make money.
Yeah, I have to make money. I love making money. And it just gives me that liberated life of freedom, which I have now, which is amazing. So I guess Liberate with LaRisha really came out of all of my lived experience, all of my professional experience. I've been a banker, financial specialist, a debt collector, financial hardship. I've worked at Women's Legal Service in the Financial Abuse Protection Unit as well. So I've just gone through all of these different financial worlds, and I guess at the end of it, I really just wanted to bring everything together because whether we like it or not, finance is interconnected with everything in this world that we have. Mm. And I guess my part in what I do is really around the financial wellness aspect. You know, how does money make you feel? How it makes you feel spiritually, mentally, physically, and emotionally as well. So that's what I really focus on when I do teach financial literacy education. And then obviously everything that I've learned, I just want to share with as many people as I can. I think in the last 6 years, I've taught over 9,000 girls and women financial literacy education, which is amazing because when I think about it, when I was your age, finance was not a subject in school.
No, and yeah. The other thing is that girls and women are often discouraged from talking about finances. And maybe that's changing for you in the room, but it just wasn't part of the conversation. And so it was often sort of, oh, well, the male partner does that or the father does that or, you know, which is just a load of codswallop, really, isn't it? So, I mean, what do you think that is? Why is it so gendered, this relationship with money, with finance, with economics?
Yeah, well, the patriarchy, for one. And they really set up a system that wasn't here, that wasn't, you know, built for us. It was really against us. And I guess growing up so hyper-independent, and my biggest thing is I love to prove people wrong. So I was like, you know what, I can learn all of this information. You know, there's some times where I'm the only woman in a lot of rooms, especially in the finance industry, can get a lot. You know, I'm a chair of a board, a director of a board, and they're like, what is this little girl like coming in here to tell me? Or if I'm doing my financial literacy workshops, because I also do it with staff members in an organization, and they're like, you know, I'm making $200,000 a year. Like, what is she going to teach me? So I guess, yeah, it's just really funny in that sense is that, you know, they can really put that limitation on you when really that's just them, you know, projecting that onto you because they don't want you to know what your power is.
Where does that power come from for you then? I mean, when you walk into a room, like I remember I did an engineering degree back in the day before I became a radio broadcaster and it was like, I did, and part of doing engineering was also being told, oh, well, girls can't do engineering. So it was like, well, I'll do that then, you know. And so for you, what, you know, that for me it was a sort of stubbornness. Well, if you tell me I can't do something, I'm going to do it and I'm going to beat the boys. And I did, just for the record. but what's inside you that powers you into a room full of men in a financial conversation?
Definitely the younger version of myself. Obviously, my mothers, all the girls and women, all the First Nations girls and women, that's what really drives me through everything that I do. But most importantly, it's the younger self, the younger version of LaRisha. That's what really drives me.
Yeah, what's she saying to you?
She's like, girl, you can do whatever you want. And it's fine to, you know, start life over whenever you need to. But yeah, and also just take up any opportunities. Like, I literally did anything. At one point in my life, I was working in the emergency department and the intensive care unit. I was like, I don't know what any of this is happening. It's scaring me. And yeah, it was just obviously not my vibe. So then I obviously went back into finance. So I literally just said yes to everything that I ever could have been given. Whether it was something completely out of my realm, I just gave it a go anyways. And I think it's really cool because even though I worked in health for a little bit, like those friendships, those people that I met, my mentors, I still talk to them to this day. And it's really cool. I've had a lot of full circle moments where, you know, I've gone back to my residential care. I taught all of my old youth workers how to support young people with financial literacy education. So that was like a huge full circle moment. Going back to my high school and then just going back to, you know, my old workplaces as well and teaching them how to be better managers. But yeah, it's just so funny. There's so many full circle moments, and you may think that you meet someone when you're young and they won't be important later on, but I've got so many lifelong friends that I've met at events like these as well that I still talk to this day, and especially my mentors and the people that really believed in me along the way as well. And I guess those teachers that really support and love and, like, you know, empower you throughout school. Like, I definitely would not have made it without them.
I love those stories about the power of sometimes accidental mentors that come into your life, you know. They just see you and they see a potential in you. And then it's only sort of years later that you realise how powerful they are. I'm also interested in the fact that this isn't just personal for you. It's not just little Larisha that's kind of pulsing inside you. It's 65,000 years of history. And so for you, this financial literacy quest, empowering girls and women around financial literacy, is also a political quest as well, isn't it? It's a First Nations social justice quest. It's an economic justice quest because it goes deep back in time, and particularly the post-colonial story.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, like, when you think about it, I guess my grandmother, who was, you know, two generations away, and she was taken to Palm Island where she was living on the dormitory there, and, you know, then my mum was sent away to Cherbourg, and it's like, that wasn't that long ago. And they always talk about it like it was so, so far away. But, you know, having that taken away from you and that economic empowerment and then even the equity within the world that we all operate in, and, you know, a lot of First Nations people still are experiencing that inequality, especially through the work that I do with Happy Boxes Project, is we send out pads, tampons, all essential items for girls and women out in remote communities. Because when you go out there, a box of pads could be like $12, $14 just for a box of pads. So
it's appalling, isn't it?
Yeah, which is just insane.
The fundamental materials of dignity.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess, yeah, that's definitely my purpose for sure. I guess, like, I live in a very matriarchal bloodline. So I guess being that person, being able to talk about these things now, where my grandparents obviously weren't allowed to, my mom wasn't allowed to. So I guess that's definitely my power as well, is that I've got a mouth and I'll talk as well. And I'm not afraid to talk about money. And also, you know, making sure that we all have equal access to it. I guess it's really amazing in these days is that, you know, there's so many Indigenous women that are in business, that are buying homes, even kids in school, which is so crazy to me. When I go and do sessions in schools and they're like, oh, well, I've already got a business. I'm like, girl, that's just amazing. So, yeah, I guess it's just that historic thing, that generational thing as well, but also spiritually is a huge thing, is that, you know, us as women, we carry, I think it was 12 generations of our mother's DNA. So that's how many women that we've got in our DNA, and that's how many women that we're representing. yeah. of just us as a physical embodiment of who we are, which is our ancestors.
That's so powerful, isn't it? And, I mean, another thing is that financial disadvantage gets handed down through those generations too, and it's usually systemic, isn't it? It's sort of, well, you know, people 12 generations ago, sometimes they'll have a house passed down and wealth passed down across those 12 generations, but that was sort of, that possibility was sort of cut by colonialism. And you're about disrupting that, shifting that. And I love a quote. Can I just read one of your favourite quotes, which is, "To liberate ourselves is to honour the strength of our ancestors and the dreams of our descendants." I love that.
First Nations economic justice advocate Larisha Jerome of Liberate with Larisha. She's also chair of the Jarrawa Aboriginal Corporation and a board director of the Happy Boxes Project. Now let's get to know the Cairns Young Woman of the Year. She's in Year 12 this year at Cairns State High School. Her name is Claudia Karovsky, and she is one political creature, as we heard earlier.
Claudia Karovsky, hello.
Hello.
Financial independence is important, but political power is important too, isn't it?
Very.
So where did that come from for you? I mean, yes, it was. You were saying before that you were witnessing, and you do witness and continue to witness, misogyny. People think it's just a joke to tease a girl, but it's not a joke. It's a serious barrier. But where did that emerge from for you, that kind of nous to call that stuff out?
Well, I guess for me, so for some context, my dad is Polish and he grew up in communist Poland. So he obviously had all those sort of progressive views that he carried. But I guess moving to Australia, because he moved to Australia at 19 to escape conscription in Poland. So he moved to Australia and I guess he kind of fed into some political propaganda when he first moved here. And I guess growing up, because it's just dad and I just live with my single dad, I guess he sort of fed some of that propaganda onto me. And I guess when I sort of grew older and I started having those mature conversations in class and things like that, I wanted to form a political belief of my own. I think it's very important for everyone to, you can be nonpartisan, that's great, you know, having neutrality, but it's also great to sort of have a moral foundation so that you know what you believe in. So I guess when I started to develop those beliefs myself, I realised how important they were. And young people don't care about politics. People don't like politicians, that's okay. But I definitely do think there's a big gap with civic education as well. And I wanted to learn more about politics. And yeah, there are not enough young people in that political space. I mean, I don't think anyone in Cairns who is my age knows how to vote. So I'm very passionate about getting young people involved. Sometimes I'll just watch a parliamentary sitting and there is no mention of young people at all. There's no mention of young people. There's no mention of the implications for regional areas. There's no implications on how we can make improvements to regional areas. So if I myself can, you know, approach a politician and go, hey, this is what young people want. This is what I want. And hopefully they can take that. So any little bit I try to take, and I implore everyone in this room to do so too.
Yeah, that's really important that you point out the lack of representation of young people in politics. But also, what does that mean for how governments, how politicians address the needs of young people?
Exactly. So when there are not enough young people in politics, you sort of have the older politicians and they make decisions on the onus of what they used to, like the society they used to live in. And unfortunately, that is not the case considering we are living in a modern era. You know, youth mental health, big issue. Yeah. Cost of living, very substantial issue. I think a lot of people right now are scared to graduate high school and go into that market of rent, affording food, affording uni, very imperative issues. And the government, they do try their best to address it, but I definitely do think there's not enough youth involvement. At the moment in Queensland, Ariana Doolan is our youngest female MP. She is 22 years old, which is great. Great, but we definitely need more young change makers in the parliament. We need more young change makers who actually stand in that seat and say to their premier or the leader of the opposition that we need so-and-so. So it's very hard as a young person, you know, seeing these issues not getting addressed, and it just, guess, like fuels up an anger inside of you. But once again, young people are scared to say what they believe in sometimes because it's that shame culture, or they're embarrassed to do things because they might be looked down upon by their peers. I've experienced that when I was in year 9 and year 10. I was scared to tell people what I was passionate about just for the pure sake of being gossiped about at school. But I think as I've grown up and I've realized that politics is actually a space I want to make change in, that I don't really care what you think about me.
Yeah.
If I care about this issue, I'm going to talk about it, and hopefully by me talking about it, people will actually acknowledge that it's opinion worth making change on.
Yeah, but I mean, you say you don't care what people think about you, but in what you're doing, it's fundamentally about care, and it's about caring for other people, isn't it? It's about building a community where we see each other and we reach out and we care for each other. And that's what you're doing with the Gratitude Initiative too, isn't it? Tell us about that.
Yes. So early this year, I founded a charity called the Gratitude Initiative. We're based in Cairns, Mackay, Rockhampton and Townsville.
Oh, wow.
And essentially, it honestly just came together because a few of my friends and I were like, I think there's a big discrepancy between empowering young women, empowering young girls, especially things with like period poverty, especially with things of what Larisha said earlier about them not having adequate resources in regional areas. So essentially what we just do is we target fundraisers to young people. So we'll make colouring pages, or we'll just go to, you know, kindergartens and we'll read a book, or we'll just hold fundraisers like colour runs or just a little sausage sizzle at Bunnings. And we're like, hey, we're going to take these funds and we're going to distribute them across the region. So we're going to go out to hospitals. We're going to do all these little things. And that's exactly what the Gratitude Initiative is. Basically just being grateful, because for me, I have grown up in a position where I'm just grateful. Like, there are people in third world countries who unfortunately don't have all of the same opportunities that I have. And I guess having that, especially going into the political sector of what I'm passionate about, there's a big gap between politicians and real people. They don't really know how it is to just be an average person living an everyday life. So for me, I'm so incredibly grateful to have all these things. I'm so grateful to wake up. I'm so grateful to go to school. Like, it's the little things in life that you don't realize, that you take for granted, essentially. So the Gratitude Initiative is just us being so grateful for what we have that we just want to distribute that to young people across Queensland. So, yeah.
Incredible. What impact do you think you're having so far?
Yeah, so it's definitely getting other young people wanting to speak up about it as well. We have over 70 ambassadors across Queensland that are interested in volunteering at our events. They're interested in attending. They're interested in, you know, going into those more authority roles. And I think through that, you see more women wanting to be change makers. It doesn't necessarily have to be through politics, you know. You can be a doctor, you can be an engineer, but you can still advocate for more women in those spaces. You don't necessarily have to be the prime minister to make change. If you honestly just have those little conversations at school, like, hey, what do you think about this? Don't you think this is a bit odd? Those are the little conversations that will end up building up and building up, and people will realise that women actually care about these issues, and hopefully it will get addressed.
And that thing about girls and women lifting each other up as well, because, you know, sometimes people can kind of pull each other down.
Exactly.
And that's actually sort of more about misogyny around us, I think. It kind of
100%.
Pits women against girls and women against women,
yes,
rather than going, well, let's lift each other up, people.
Exactly, exactly.
What about being involved in the youth parliament? The youth member of parliament. That must have been a surreal... And then you also did some work experience in the former MP Warren Ench's office.
Yes.
So you're really letting it rip in the political sphere. But what was that like? Did that feel like a token experience? Because sometimes these initiatives are put together for young people and it can feel really patronising and really sort of lacking in authenticity. It's like, oh, well, we've got the youth vote now.
So for some context, the YMCA Queensland Youth Parliament is... So you have the real parliament in Queensland, so that's 93 electorates. They sit right in Gardens Point. And then you have the Queensland Youth Parliament. So it's essentially getting 93 young representatives and they mirror those seats. So you'll have a Cairns representative, a Townsville, et cetera, et cetera. In 2024, I was the youngest member in the program. So the program is 15 to 25 years old. I was the youngest member for Cairns, and I was fortunate to be in the Queensland Cabinet in my first year, which was great, you know, a youth cabinet. And then this year, when I decided to apply for a second year in the program, because you can only do the program for 2 years, I decided to go more into the leader part of it, and I was voted as the Youth Minister for Health, which is great. I think a great thing about the Queensland Youth Parliament is that it's non-partisan. So it's not about what political party you're from. It's literally about what do you care about? Because essentially what Queensland Youth Parliament is you write legislation. So if
A few years ago, the health committee wrote a legislation about having free sanitary products in schools, so free tampons, free pads. And what happens is that when that bill is passed, it goes to the Queensland Cabinet. So that sanitary bill about having free tampons and pads in school went to Shannon Fentiman, the minister at the time. And she read this and she went, this is a fantastic idea. And that is exactly why we now have free tampons and pads in schools. So I think the Queensland Youth Parliament is an amazing avenue to really get your voice heard. And I definitely do think, since it has that nonpartisan aspect, it really just attracts people in Queensland who want to make genuine change.
So you applied for it? You can apply
for
it?
Yes, you can apply for it. Applications
open. Something to keep in mind.
Applications open early 2026. So apply to be in your electorate. It is a wonderful opportunity and I implore you all to apply. It was definitely one of the best experiences of my life. You actually do get to sit in the Queensland Parliament. You get to do a debate. You get to do a private member statement. You get to talk about an issue you're passionate about and you get to talk about the legislation you wrote. So it's a very imperative program, and I think it's a great Queensland government initiative because it really is getting young people from their communities, not because they want to be a career politician, but they care about an issue and they want to, you know, make change in the law about it.
I love the fact that when you did a placement with Warren Entsch, the former MP, you wrote three speeches for him.
Yes.
Yeah, I love that.
Yes, yes.
What message would you have for your teenage self now, Monique?
I think for me, it's something I'm still working on, but anytime I would have an interaction, I took it so personally that it was my fault or a reflection on me. So like working with coaches, for example, I had one coach who only gave his feedback in yelling. Mm. And I would internalize that as I'm the problem, I'm the issues with me, rather than maybe they're having a bad day. I mean, this coach was just not good. But, you know, a lot of the time we're our own, you know, we're the star of our journey, we're the main character in our lives, but sometimes we've got to step back and see where the other person is coming from. Maybe it's not a reflection of us. And, you know, on the other side of that, make sure that we're always open to listening and learning. It's okay to take a chapter of your own book, step back and listen to someone else, hear another perspective, because it will change the way that you think and approach something.
That is so good. That thing about not taking it personally, sometimes it's more about their issue and not yours. But often I think this is particularly the case for girls and women, we internalise things and we have a kind of lot of self-doubt and a lot of self-blame, and it's kind of more about what society says about us than actually the reality, isn't it? Yeah. Larisha, what message would you have for your little self?
One, stay authentic at all times. Know your worth and be unapologetic about it. Throughout everything in your personal, professional life, that gets you a long way.
What does it mean to be authentic to you?
Just being who you are and not being shame, not having any limitations on yourself that other people put on you. So, definitely being authentic just means being who you truly want to be without other people defining who you are. You get to define who you are.
Mm, love that. Nasteo.
I would say it's okay, you got time. You don't have to have it all figured out. You don't need to know the answers. It would all work out. For now, do it for the plot. Do all the side quests that you can and it will all work out in the end.
Yeah, there's often that thing about having to rush stuff, and I always have thought that it's kind of crazy that they expect you to work out what career you want to do. You know, make all those subject choices in the last 2 years of high school. That's impossible. I mean, I did a sort of mix of subjects and then I went and did engineering and then I became a radio broadcaster. Like, there are so many different pathways. I mean, we heard it from Larisha, so many different pathways that you can take. So, yeah, to know that there's more than those last 2 years and even the choices you make in the first few years after school. Yeah, for sure. Claudia, what about you?
Don't compare yourself to others. That's just going to spiral you in hours of overthinking. I'm a certified overthinker. It's horrible. And I guess also not getting knocked down by adversity. Like, I know, especially us in the room, if you want to be a leader, and let's say you go for school captain, and let's say you don't get school captain, don't it's not that deep. It's high school. A lot of the things that happen in high school don't is not going to reflect what you're going to do outside of high school. And that's a lesson I'm honestly teaching myself. So you really just want to, if you get knocked down by adversity, yes, it's okay to be knocked down for a bit, but you want to get back up and realize that that one instance does not define who you are. You have so much opportunity and you have so much life left to live. So, yeah.
That's how do you know all that stuff? I'm still working that out. I love that. I mean, as a panel, we also traverse about 4 or 5 different decades. So it's kind of really nice to be on this panel that's diverse in life experience, cultural background, age. I love that. And I mean, something I would say is that you can always learn from people who have had a whole other life experience to you and people of different ages. You know, the people that I've observed in my life who seem to be really kicking on and thriving are those who have intergenerational friendships and relationships. You know, they've got elders in their life that they're really close to, and they also have young people coming up as well. Those are intergenerational relationships. I really miss my grandma, is what I will say. We're going to round off this session and hand it over to Jo, but via the wonderful Naz, who has brought one of her poems with her, one of her compositions. It is a really poignant story. Take it away. The floor is yours.
This poem is called Home. Is a representation of my mother's journey, especially the experiences that she has gone through when we first came here. She is a Muslim woman. She wears the hijab. A lot of the time she wears her abayas. And so she fully presents as a Muslim woman. And when she goes out, at the first 3 years, I don't know what happened, if racism just went away suddenly, but we would go out of the house and there were people yelling at us to go back to where we came from or calling us really derogatory names that I don't want to repeat here. And she would come home and she would be in tears and she looked really sad, and I didn't understand that because I was like, this is what you wanted. You wanted us to move here, to live in this country. Why are you suddenly so sad about it? Even though she didn't understand what they were saying at the time, it had a great impact on her. Until one day I went out with her, and there was a group of young people in there throwing rubbish at us, and I was like, oh, this is your daily experience, and this is why you feel this way, and this is why you're so down. And that's when I wrote this poem. So the poem is called Home, and this is how it goes. We're a refugee not because we chose to be, but we've been told we are. We're a refugee not because we chose to be, but we were told to be. We're a refugee not because we chose to be, but we've been told we are. We're from a world of delusion. We wait for beginning, conclusion, and a great mental confusion that can maybe be called for a revolution. I'm a refugee not because I chose to be, but I've been told I am. I'm a refugee not because I chose to be, but I was forced to be. I'm from a wall of delusion. I wait for beginning, conclusion, and a great mental confusion that can maybe be called for revolution. I wait for a mountain that I can't climb with the heartache of tension and the timeline of depression. We're a refugee not because we chose to be, but we've been told we are. Calling me all these names, wondering why I'm still here. We're refugee not because we chose to be, but we've been told we are. I hope one day you can understand no one puts their newborn baby on a boat unless the ocean is safer than the land. I hope one day you can understand no one leaves home unless home becomes what burns your feet, forcing you to run. I hope one day you can understand no one leaves home unless home becomes the thing that chases you barefoot. We're refugee not because we chose to be, but we've been told we are. We're refugee not because we chose to be, but we were forced to be. So I hope one day you can understand no one leaves home unless home becomes the thing that burns your feet, forcing you to run. Thank you.
Naz Mokhtar. And with that, can I please get you to thank Larisha Jerome, Naz Mukhtar, Claudia Kurovsky, and Monique Murphy. What stories, hey? Nasteo Mukhtar is program coordinator at the social enterprise Ethne and co-founder of another called Mauer Boutique. First Nations economic justice advocate Larisha Jerome of Liberate with Larisha.
Cairns Young Woman of the Year, Year 12 student Claudia Karovsky, Paralympian and body positivity advocate Monique Murphy. You heard them all. And big thanks to WOW, or the Women of the World Festival, Brisbane. Next on the show, the New York Times' Masha Gessen, Stasiland author Anna Funder, and fascism scholar Jason Stanley. On fascism, is that what we're witnessing in America? It's one not to miss. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Bye from me. And you can find all Big Ideas episodes on the ABC Listen app. And if you love the show, leave us a review wherever you find the Big Ideas podcast. Our email address, bigideas@abc.net.au. We love getting your messages. Catch you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.